Welcome to the Maria Heller Show. On the net since 2000 and still going strong. If you feel like you're not getting the real news, if you feel like you're not connected spiritually, you have found your home. Maria covers a wide range of topics as only a snarky New Yorker can. Straight up, no chaser. No censorship, no corporate sponsors, thus true freedom of speech. Your subscription gives you unlimited access as a member of the smartest audience on earth. Relax and enjoy the education. Now here's Maria.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. Welcome to the show. Today is a special day in two different ways, one good, one bad. And I have an extremely fabulous guest with me today. A lot of you are familiar with his work. His name is Miko Peled, or Peled. He is an Israeli-American. He's the author of The General's Son. He's an Israeli-American activist. He's an author and, believe it or not, a karate instructor. He's had quite the interesting life, for sure. And today is an interesting day because today is Palestinians' Nakba Day and Israel's Independence Day. And this is something that Americans are not taught in history. And today is going to be a very important show to educate you on that. So I'm very happy to have Miko with me. Good morning, Miko.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure to have you. You know, you have a very interesting story, and I think that it's good for people to know that you are an Israeli, and sort of like the Buddha, you went out into the Palestinian world to see for yourself what was going on, and I assume that that changed your life. But before we get into your story, can you give people a brief idea of what Nakba Day is about, which translates Day of the Catastrophe?
Sure. I got to say, I love the analogy. I never thought of it, the Buddha going out there, but there is a similarity there. So I appreciate the analogy.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Although I'm far from achieving my spiritual enlightenment. So the Nakba Day is a day that Palestinians remember the Nakba, the catastrophe, the destruction of Palestine, the forced exile of close to a million Palestinians, the destruction of hundreds upon hundreds of Palestinian towns and villages, the destruction of homes and schools and mosques, the destruction of a nation and a people and a country that was Palestine, and one day it was called Palestine for, you know, since about the Bronze Age until 1948. And one day, suddenly, people came, took over and called it Palestine. And I mean, sorry, came and called it Israel. Mm-hmm. And they created this new thing called Israel on the ruins, on the ashes of the destroyed Palestine. As the Palestinians were being killed or being forced out, and eventually ended up, those that were not dead, ended up either displaced as refugees. And today they still languish in refugee camps some 71 years later, or as a displaced people in their own land, but with no rights. So that is what is being commemorated today. And to celebrate anything, really, on the result that was built on such destruction, I think is really a terrible, terrible thing.
Well, I agree. You know, years ago I had Howard Zinn on my program. I'm sure you're familiar with Howard and his work. And Howard was talking about Holocaust. And I said to Howard, well, what about the silent Holocaust that's happening right now? And he said, what are you talking about, Maria? And I said, the silent Holocaust that's happening to the Palestinians. And Howard took pause and he said that that was exactly the proper way to describe the open air prison that the Palestinians are living under now.
Yes, I think that the way that I would describe Gaza is more than an open air prison. You know, it's really a concentration camp. Mm-hmm. And I just came back from a trip to Ukraine, working on some research for a book that I'm about to write, that I'm working on right now, a new book about the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community And of course, many of them came from areas that are today Ukraine. It used to be Poland, it used to be Hungary, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you see the cemeteries, and you walk through the streets. It used to be ghettos and concentration camps and so forth, and when terrible massacres took place, and people stood by and either did nothing or participated.
Right.
And so when we see what is happening in the Gaza Strip today, and when I see millions of Israelis standing by, not only doing nothing, but voting for the exact people who committed these crimes and who perpetuate these crimes, it's a terrible, terrible sensation. It's a terrible thing to see, you know, the willingness of people to stand by.
Right.
And either do nothing or participate when such terrible crimes are being perpetrated.
Right. Well, you know, on another level, you can see the same thing happening in the United States now, where the rule of law doesn't mean anything. You have Trump pretty much echoing Netanyahu, who would like nothing better than to get rid of his Supreme Court. You look at, you know, Trump arguing against Congress and the courts. So this seems to be a worldwide issue of, I want to call it leaping fascism. Unfortunately, this has been happening to the Palestinians, you know, and nobody seems to be paying attention. I mean, I've been covering it for 20 years on my show. But, you know, as a Bible student, I don't recall the Bible talking about a land called Israel, but I surely know that Palestine is listed in the Bible. So how is it that the Zionists, I guess is the right word, are able to convince people that somehow they have some kind of biblical okay to just go in and steal that land from the Palestinians?
Well, the narrative, or the false narrative, I should say, that the Zionists created was, first of all, completely ignoring the history of the land and the richness and the plurality of the history of this land. Then they said, well, the Jews around the world are not a religion. They are a nation. In other words, they are a nation that is like all of the nations, and it has a history. And that history of these Jews is the Bible, the Old Testament. So they secularized the Bible. They turned Judaism from a religion to a nationality. Mm-hmm. And then they said, Palestine is our homeland. Now, this is all based on mythology. This is all based, none of it is based on history. Mm-hmm. And there they had it. And they were able to convince the powers that be around the world, because this biblical narrative was something that was very appealing to the leaders of particularly of Europe and the United States. And they bought it. They bought it because the leaders of the Zionist movement in the early days, in the early 20th century, you know, they were educated, they were very liberal, they were enlightened, they didn't look like Jews, they were white, they spoke many languages, they were doctors and chemists and professors and so forth, and they were white supremacist racists that thought it was okay to go and take a land from people who were brown and settle it with people who are white, who are European, basically. Mm-hmm. And that is why the powers of the world, the UK and the US particularly, were quite happy to support them. And this is the false narrative that they created. And there's a wonderful book that just came out called Palestine, a 4,000-year history by the historian Nur Masalha. And he shows very clearly that the name Palestine has been used for close to 4,000 years to describe that particular land.
Right.
So the biblical narrative, even though it was false, it stuck.
Right.
Because the people who were selling it were very good at what they were doing.
Well, you can see that same crap happening in the United States now with these anti-abortion laws, all this other stuff. It all goes down to the Bible, which most of them have never read. And, you know, even calling ourselves a Christian nation, where I don't really see any evidence of any true Christianity going around. But when we get back to this Nakba, when I was reading, you know, reading up on you, reading up on that, this supposedly happened, I don't know, in Ernst, this was supposedly 1948, okay, the year before I was born, when all the true Semites were rushed off their own land. But my understanding of history is this goes back earlier to the Balfour Declaration in 1917, where the Rothschild family, you know, basically went and said, let's write this paper and just give Palestine as a national home for the Jewish people. So what happened between 1917 and 1948 to make it where, did it take them that long to go in for the slaughter?
Well, it was a process. It wasn't only the Rothschild family. These were the leaders of the Zionist movement at the time who worked very hard, and you got to hand it to them. They did a very good job in convincing the government of the greatest empire that existed at that time, right after World War One, where they were victorious and they conquered large parts of the Middle East, to promise a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. Now, again, it's really one group of white racists giving a land to another group of white racists, even though the land belonged to a third group of people. Mm-hmm. But that group of people was brown, and therefore they didn't matter. And then from the Balfour Declaration, which, by the way, was a result of long negotiations between the Zionist leaders and the British government, in other words, the paper that turned out to be the Balfour Declaration was the result of negotiations. The Zionists, of course, wanted it to say a lot more. And it was presented, like you said, as a paper from Lord Balfour, who was the foreign secretary, to Rothschild. As a promissory note. And from that point on, really, the British did everything they possibly could to support the Zionist movement and to support the creation of this white European colony for Jews on the backs of the Palestinians. And the Palestinians did try to rebel. They rebelled from 1936 to 1939. There was a great Arab revolt, and it was crushed mercilessly by the Brits. The methods used by the Brits, poisoning wells and executing people in broad daylight and so on and so forth, destroying villages and so on. And at the end of 1939, at the end of this revolt, of course, the Palestinians were left with nothing. And meantime, the Zionist militia, this small group of very dedicated young men, my father was one of them, were being trained to become a military force, to become armed and trained militia. And they were trained by the Brits, and they're armed by the Brits. And eventually, in 1948, they were prepared, or by the end of 1947, they were prepared, and they had a very well thought out and well written, well planned plan of ethnic cleansing and conquest. Mm. And within the year, between the end of 1947 and the end of 1948. They managed to conquer almost the entire country and kick out two-thirds of the people.
Right, right. Well, you know, many years ago, actually when I started my show, it's almost 20 years ago, I had covered this author's book, which I believe everyone should read, which was called The World is a Ghetto. I believe the author was Charles Winant. And he talks about the war on the dark races since the beginning of time. He doesn't leave any time period out. And yet in America, you know, where everybody wants to believe they're not racist, even though we're openly racist society, it would be interesting if people actually knew the history you're talking about and the history that I've covered for so many years. And the truth of the matter is, the Palestinians, you know, here in America, they like to use the term constantly, oh, you're an anti-Semite if you say anything against the state of Israel and the government of Israel. But it's my understanding that the Palestinians are the true Semites. You know, I grew up in New York where, you know, there were a lot of Sephardic Jews. And, you know, they were connected to the bloodline. But people that just assume the Jewish religion seem to hide behind that. When it's the true Semites, in my opinion, that are the ones that are being slaughtered and suffering. Am I wrong on that?
No, you're absolutely, you're not wrong. I mean, I my grandparents immigrated in the 20s. My grandfather was a leader, an important leader in the Zionist movement. And my father was a general, he was an officer and then a general. I have every right to live there, to come and go as I please. And I don't think there's a drop of Semitic DNA in me. Mm-hmm. DNA in me. I mean, there's nothing Semitic about me. My roots are Russian, and that's it, or Ukrainian.
Right.
And that's that. But that's not the point, because what they did was they completely changed the narrative. They changed the narrative in order to suit the political needs of the settler colonial ambitions of the Zionist movement, which was to take over Palestine and get rid of the Palestinians. And it hasn't stopped. In other words, people tend to say the Nakba took place in 1948. The Nakba began in 1948. It's still going on. It never ended.
Of course.
The forced expulsion, the massacres, the destruction of homes and towns and neighborhoods happens on a regular basis every single day. There's not, almost not a day goes by without Palestinians being killed, Palestinians being pushed out of their homes, Palestinians being arrested, Palestinian children being arrested. Mm-hmm. I hope their listeners know about Betty McCollum and the important bill that she has reintroduced into the new Congress, demanding that USAID money does not go to support the detention and torture of Palestinian children, which is a regular practice by Israelis. It's a very good bill. People should read it and then demand that they're mm-hmm. a representative, co-sponsor with Betty McCollum. And so, you know, this is a reality that has never stopped and it's been 71 years, which is a very, very long time.
Right. Well,
but
you know.
It's a narrative.
Right. I mean, I constantly watch the ever-shrinking map of Palestine and as it gets swallowed up by the Zionist movement. And there's very little left. And I did want to ask you, what did you think about the fact that Trump handed over basically the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, and now he's also putting out that if Israel goes to war against the Gazans and they don't accept his peace proposal, that the U.S. will be on Israel's side against them?
Well, the U.S. has been on the Israeli side against them from day one, so there's no change. There's not going to be that much of a change.
Right.
It's not like there's an army on the Gaza side. They don't even have a tank. There's never been an army in Gaza. So Israel is getting the weapons and the ammunition and everything from the Americans as much as they want anyway. So for the Gazans, there's really nothing going to be different.
Well, he is going to get a town named after him, or a village square. I see that was probably one of the rewards to Trump, who is trying to pose as a Christian in America. It's just crazy to me what goes on. It's just nuts.
It is nuts, and it's horrifying when you have racist right wing lunatics running the country. But this is exactly what it is. It's like you said earlier about their both Netanyahu and Trump are fighting the very foundations of democracy. You know, the House of Representatives and the Supreme Court.
Right.
And the courts in general, actually, they're trying to change the makeup of the courts so that they can get away with human rights abuses and with their own corruption.
Exactly.
But this is what right wing fascism is all about. That's why
right.
they are who they are.
Right. But when most Americans think about Israel, they believe that Israel is a democracy. How could Israel be a democracy the way that it operates?
Because it's like America can be a democracy. It's a democracy for a privileged few. It's a democracy for Jews, like America is a democracy for the white privileged people. You know, I just published a book called Injustice about the Holy Land Foundation, which was a Muslim charity. They were closed down after 9/11, and five honest, good men are in federal prison now on terrorism charges for very, very long, many, many years, you know, up to 65 years, for doing nothing wrong other than they were Muslims and Palestinians here in America. Mm-hmm. And the assumption that there are civil liberties in America is an assumption that only white people can make. You know, blacks have never had enjoyed civil liberties here, neither did other colored minorities.
Right.
So it's a democracy for the privileged white people. And Israel is a democracy if you're Jewish. It's a Jewish democracy. It's not a democracy if you're anything else. And anything else is, of course, Palestinian. So it can get away with saying that it's a democracy because it's a democracy for some people. So it's all you have to do is kind of finish the sentence and say it's a democracy, but only for Jews. And by the way, Jews today, numerically, are a minority in Palestine, because Palestinians are a majority today. Between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea, out of about 12 million people, Palestinians are close to 7 million. So they are the majority. Mm-hmm. But it's a democracy for Jewish people. And now, of course, with the attack on the courts, and the changing of the laws, which Netanyahu is proposing to do now, it's going to be less and less of a democracy, even for Jews who dare to dissent. And actually, there are not that many people who, there are not many dissenters among Israelis anyway. But that's how they do it.
Right, right. It's disgusting. Well, what did you think about basically Trump handing over the Golan Heights to Netanyahu?
Well, it's the same thing as Jerusalem. You know, it's part of what they call the deal of the century. Recognizing Jerusalem as the capital city of Israel is like recognizing that Paris is the capital city of Italy. It makes absolutely no diplomatic or legal sense because Jerusalem has never been recognized as part of the state of Israel. Israel occupied half of it illegally in 1948, conducted an absolute ethnic cleansing campaign. Not a single Palestinian remained in West Jerusalem after 1948, even though the neighborhoods were there and the homes are there and so forth, the lands are there. 100% ethnic cleansing. 20 years later, in 67, they took the eastern part of Jerusalem, and they're in the process of doing the same thing in East Jerusalem. Now, besides all that, when Palestine was partitioned and a Jewish state was, you know, was supposed to be created, Jerusalem was not part of it. Jerusalem was supposed to be a sovereign entity. So the consulates, and there are consulates and diplomatic missions in Jerusalem, but they predate the state of Israel and they report to their capital. They're not part of the embassies that exist in Tel Aviv. So in every which way you look at it, it was not only reckless and stupid, but it was also an enormous violation of diplomacy and international law. But this is part of Trump's plan. It's really Netanyahu's plan that Trump is executing to give everything to Israel at the expense of the Palestinians. So Jerusalem was the biggest prize. Jerusalem was the biggest prize anybody could give Netanyahu, and Trump gave it to him.
Right.
Then the Golan Heights, you know, I think the Golan Heights was really just to see, just kind of a prelude to the fact that they are going to recognize Israeli sovereignty over the West Bank, or what they call Judea and Samaria. And that is really going to be the final gift to
right.
Israel, and the final blow to Palestinians. Basically, he's saying there's no such thing as Palestine. There are no Palestinians. The rumor has it that the plan includes renaming a small sliver of Palestine that will be given to the Palestinians and calling it New Palestine.
Oh,
so in other words, a name that's been used for 5,000 years is now going to be called New Palestine, which is absurd. But this
right.
is part of the plan. This is exactly what they're going to do.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you see Trump amping up the war horns, we'll call it, towards Iran. And, you know, this is more, you know, supposed intel that came from Israel. So, you know, the U.S. has done Israel's foreign policy for many, many years. You know, a lot of Americans don't know that when the Holocaust was going on in Europe, that the Americans turned away ships with Jewish refugees on it. We didn't accept them into our country with the cheap excuse that they didn't want to break up families because there were a lot of women and children without husbands on those ships. And yet the U.S. puts itself out as this beacon of light and freedom for everyone else in the world. So I guess what's going on with the migrants at the border is nothing new for the United States.
No, well, it's not. It is nothing new. You're absolutely right. It's the exact same travesty. The migrants at the border are all there, and they're migrants, and they had to be forced to leave their countries because of U.S. policy in Latin America. So in other words, there's very little new here. And you're right. I mean, the U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East has been written by Israel and the Israeli lobby for many, many years now. This is a new level. In other words, now it's reached a whole new level with Jerusalem and the recognition of Israeli sovereignty over, over Jerusalem and, like I said, what's coming, which is going to be the West Bank.
Right. Well, I mean, on a good news, a lot of Americans now, American Jews, 50% of them are against supporting Israel now. And probably more than 50% are against Donald Trump. It's because I don't like to blame this on a religion. And I've had a hard time for years trying to explain to people there's a big difference between Judaism and Zionism. You know, one is a religion, the other one is a fascist political movement. But, you know, I guess the media and fake history has convinced people that they're one of the same.
Well, they've also redefined, the Zionists have redefined anti-Semitism, the new definition of anti-Semitism, which includes criticism of Israel. So now you and I are by definition anti-Semitic because of the way we're talking. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the Zionist hijacked Judaism. Mm-hmm. Anti-Semitism is racism that is targeting Jews. Anti-Zionism is fighting racism, because right. Zionism is a racist ideology, and Israel is a racist project.
Right.
So to say that somebody who opposes Zionism and opposes Israel is somehow anti-Semitic is the craziest thing you could possibly say.
Right.
Because if you support Israel, you are supporting one of the most brutal racist regimes that ever existed.
I agree, and you know, a lot of people
and if
don't.
If you oppose it, you can't be racist.
Right.
It does, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
And, you know, there always have been, and still are, very large Jewish communities. Many of them are descendants of Holocaust survivors who oppose Israel and oppose Zionism. You live in New York, you probably know the ultra-Orthodox Jews who are now spreading all over upstate New York, and about whom I'm writing this new book.
Right.
These are enormous communities, hundreds of thousands of people mm-hmm. up in New York, in Montreal, in Toronto, in London, who are mostly the descendants of Holocaust survivors, because these communities came to America and to the UK after World War II. Mm-hmm. And they are all of them completely reject Zionism and reject the state of Israel. You'll not find a single Israeli flag in these communities.
Right, even the Hasidic Jews, exactly. They have a whole group.
These are the Hasidic Jews. These are what I'm talking about.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, these are them. So,
right. So,
you know, the whole claim that somehow opposing Israel is anti-Semitic is ludicrous, but it's all they've got. It's, in other words, they don't have an argument. They don't have a justification. They don't have a way to legitimize what they do. So they lash out at people who oppose them using all these nonsense
words. Right. Well, you know, it reminds me when George W. Bush was president and he came out with that expression, I think it was after 9/11, why do they hate us? You know, Americans couldn't understand why do they hate us? Well, to me, it's an ever-growing list. All you have to do is look at our foreign policy. But Americans are brainwashed in school. We don't get any real history, any real information. So we buy the, you know, the myth of America. I did want to ask you, though, because I read some in your bio, and I want to make sure I got the story straight. You had your maternal grandfather, a signer of the Israeli Declaration of Independence. Your father was a general in the Israeli army. Was it your mother that refused to move into an ex-Palestinian home because she realized that it was someone else's family being kicked out for her to move in?
Yes. So I was talking about Jerusalem earlier, West Jerusalem. My mother was born and raised in Jerusalem. She still lives there. She's still alive. And in 1948, she was 22. She was already a mother. My father was out there, you know, fighting for the cause. And when West Jerusalem, the ethnic cleansing of Jerusalem was complete, all these beautiful homes, all these beautiful neighborhoods were available, were empty.
Mm-hmm.
And they were offered to Israeli families, to Jewish families. And she was living in a small apartment with her mother at the time, which must have been hell. And she was offered, and these are beautiful homes. These are beautiful, beautiful homes. Anybody who's been to Jerusalem, just particularly West Jerusalem, these neighborhoods, we call them Arab homes, although nobody ever asked the question, well, then where are the Arabs?
Right.
And she was offered one of these lovely homes, and her reaction was, and she still talks about this today, by the way, she's 92, how could I possibly take the home of another mother? How could I move into the home of another family? And then she would go on and talk about that when the people did come into these homes, they still found the coffee was still warm on the table. And then they started looting and stealing. These are well-to-do Jerusalemite families. She describes the truckloads of loot, of beautiful rugs and books and rare books and furniture and everything else. And she says, how could these people have done this? She talks about it with such great shame. She says, how could we have done it? You know, we, the Israeli people,
right.
The Jewish people. And she says to this day, and of course, we're all very grateful that she didn't. But at 22, she had the moral fortitude to say no to a beautiful, beautiful home.
Right.
And, you know, she continued to live with her mother for a long time. And then after that, I mean, you know, conditions were harsh. They were not easy. They were not wealthy. But she said no, and that was it.
Right. But with the men in your family being so prominent, you know, like I had said, you know, you know, being part of the Israeli independence and whatnot, how did that make you feel? I mean, do you feel conflicted? How were you able to see through it?
Well, at first I was very proud. I mean, growing up, I was very proud. I mean, you know, having a dad who's a general, you have no idea. But in Israel, where the army is absolutely everything, and that generation particularly was hailed as like the gods of the Olympus. So to have a dad who's one of those guys was, you know, and I had an uncle who's the president, and a great uncle who was the president while I was, you know, while I was a boy. And so we used to go to the president's mansion and all of this stuff. I mean, it was amazing. I was so proud. And then little by little, you know, the bubble burst. It didn't burst. It chipped, you know, it was chipped away at, you know, little by little by little, until eventually I did make the journey, you know, subtitle of my book, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. I took the journey and I met Palestinians. Or like you said, like the Buddha, and I saw what I saw. I stepped out of this, you know, very safe and, you know, very beautiful sphere in which the colonizer, the occupier, the live, to see what other people lived like. And I had no idea. I mean, I was shocked, of course. Mm-hmm. And then I reached the conclusions that I reached. And yes, it wasn't easy. It wasn't, it was very painful.
I would think it would be very painful. Right. I would think it would be very painful and very hard for a young person to, you know, be able to come to terms with both sides of it.
Yeah, very difficult. And eventually I had to make a choice. I mean, it was a little bit like, and, you know, I have to be, I'm grateful to my Palestinian friends who were, you know, very non-accusing and, you know, let me do this at the pace I needed to do in order to, it's like a baby, you know, walking and learning to walk and trying to let go of one thing before he holds on to the next thing, mm-hmm. or she. And that's exactly what it was like. And eventually I realized where I stand and what my role is in all of this.
Right.
It took a while, but now it's very, very clear to me, you know.
Well, I'm glad.
My family participated in a terrible, unforgivable crime. And I need to do everything I can to remedy it, to bring it to a stop and make things better.
Well, it's obviously that is what you're doing. Miko, we need to take a short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hi, this is Maria. I don't often get to talk directly to the listeners here on the Gary Noll Network, but I felt like doing that today. I know a lot of you really enjoy my show, but you might not know that I do 4 shows a week over at my website, maria.net. So if you're loving the show you get to hear on Sunday, come on over to my site and subscribe, because I've got hundreds of hours of great shows on pretty much every topic in the universe. And that again is maria.net, M-E-R-I-A.net. And now we can get back to this excellent show. Thanks.
Our founders said that it is our duty as a free republic to be an informed citizen. To that end, Maria works tirelessly to inform you about all that is going on in the world and what you can do about it. She has never sold out or bought into the system. She's here just like the rest of you, trying to figure things out. Thus, there is no corporate control of her work, just you, the subscriber. Maria offers many options to subscribe, and all are free to choose the senior plan if your budget cannot afford the others. We're the ones we've been waiting for, so don't wait any longer. Subscribe today at meria.net.
Okay, welcome back to the show. I'm speaking with Miko Peled. If you want to check out his work, I'm going to list one of his books here. But his website, I have a live link right here, and it's spelled MIKOPELED.com, in case you're listening to this on Gary Noll's network. We have a lot of heroes on this planet, but they're not getting a voice. So I am the one that likes to give them a voice. Miko, on your site, I was reading through a little bit on your blog, and you said had something very interesting there that I wanted to talk about, and not that it isn't all interesting. You said no Jews are Israelite descendants.
Yeah.
Now, that might come as a shock to a lot of Jews who think they have the sacred bloodline, like the kings and queens and dukes and duchesses over in the UK who think they're better than everybody else because they have different blood. I don't think they have any blood, to tell you the truth. So, you know, I remember, you know, being raised, you know, with the Bible shoved down my throat. I don't know if it's in the Bible or the Torah. You might be the one to tell me because I couldn't find it when I was looking for it. I was reporting on the destruction of the olive trees in Palestine by the Israeli troops. And it was my understanding, and I don't know why, that that was one of the great sins that the God of the Old Testament said, is that everyone was entitled to this sit under their own olive tree. And that was basically considered an act of war. Am I wrong on that?
No, it's a terrible crime from any perspective, religious, political, moral, spiritual, the destruction of the land, the destruction of the olive trees. But the olive trees were an important source of are an important source of income and life for the Palestinians, and they are a symbol of Palestinian life. So destroying them, these olive trees, and by the way, what they do is they don't just, quite often they destroy them, but but other times they just uproot these beautiful olive trees. Some of them are 1,000, 1,500 years old, and then they plant them in parks on the Israeli side. In other words, they steal the very essence of Palestinian life as though and pretend as though it is Israeli. It belongs to Israel. No, you know, this whole idea. I mean, there's not a single Jewish person in the world who can trace his or her family back to ancient Judea, which, by the way, was historically an incident that lasted maybe 200 years out of a 4,000-year history of Palestine. However, there are Palestinians who are sitting in refugee camps and have been in exile for over 70 years who can show you that their families have been in Palestine for hundreds, if not 1,000 years. I mean, I know people in Jerusalem mm-hmm. whose families have been there since the days of Saladin, you know, 1,000 years. They do that. And Palestinians, every Palestinian in every refugee camp you will ever go to can show you precisely where their village was, where their house was, where the well used to be, where the school was, even if there's nothing left of the village or the town anymore. So this is a reality. There are no Jews that can trace their history back to those days. It's a myth. It's all based on a myth.
Right. Well, a lot of authors have covered the fact that most of the Jews in Israel are Russians who adopted the religion, but they're not there as true Semites because they are not part of any bloodline.
Well, actually, most of the Jews in Israel are not Russian. Most of the Jews in Israel are descendants of Jews who came from Arab countries. The majority of Jews, what they call Sephardic Jews, who are Arab Jews.
Oh, okay.
Which is another interesting story because, you know, at some point, the State of Israel, after it was established, they realized that the Jews that they wanted, in other words, the white European, wealthy, educated Jews, Western European Jews, didn't come. And Holocaust survivors didn't come. Even Holocaust survivors, the vast majority, did not end up going to Israel.
Right.
So they were left with a country without people, with a state without people. So then they targeted the Jews in Arab countries. And at first they were not interested in going because they had lived there for a millennium and a millennium at least, sometimes more. And they had no intention of leaving. But eventually, it's a long story, but eventually many of them did come into what was Israel. And today the majority of Israelis are actually Arabs because these are Jews whose families came from Arab countries, and they speak mm-hmm. Arabic, and they eat Arabic food, and
right.
and they even identify themselves as Moroccan and Yemenite and Syrian and Libyan and so forth.
Oh, I might have been thinking about right. I might have been thinking back in the days of the Balfour Declaration when you had a lot of that.
Well, yeah, in the beginning
happening.
They were mostly European Jews, but the all point right. is, but you're right because the point is the same point. None of them, not the Arab Jews, not the Russian Jews, not the European Jews, none of the Jews who live in Palestine are indigenous to Palestine. They are all colonizers. They're all descendants of colonizers, and that's the problem. The Palestinians are the indigenous people. There are very, very few Jewish people whose actually families were there pre-1948 and who are, you know, pre-Zionism. Very, very few.
Right, right. Well, I also know that you're part of the movement, or at least support the movement, for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. Are you one of those speakers? Because I do get, you know, some notes. I know there's one speaker right now not being allowed into the United States to talk about this. Have you been banned from any countries to speak anywhere?
No, I'm not banned because I'm not Palestinian. I'm a white Israeli Jew, so it's very different. Omar Barghouti, who was the co-founder and one of the leaders of the cause of the movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS, was just denied a visa, which is not surprising. But yes, of course I support it. I think the Palestinians have given the world a gift with the call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. They have given us a roadmap, a pathway with which we can help bring justice to Palestine. And the demands of a call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, the demands are reasonable, remedial, probably the most reasonable demands ever made by a national liberation movement. Mm-hmm. The demands are very simple. They've all been recognized by international law. It's basically ending the military occupation, equal rights for Israelis and Palestinians, and the Palestinian return to their home and the refugee return to their homes and their land. And there's nothing about that that harms anybody. It's all remedial. Mm-hmm. And so I support it 120%. I think everybody should support it. I think it's the right thing to do. It's the right form of resistance. I don't think that solidarity is good enough anymore with Palestine. I think we should all participate in the resistance, and BDS provides us with the tools to do that, mm-hmm. because it is a form of resistance.
Right.
It's not just solidarity. It is action. These are things that we can actually do. And they have campaigns, and they've got an excellent website, bdsmovement.org. And so, and they have chapters in different cities and on different campuses and so forth. So this is definitely the right thing to do. I'm always, when I speak publicly, I'm always wearing the BDS button. I hand them out generously. And I think this is absolutely something that everybody should be part of.
Right. Well, you know, you look at the BDS movement, and we have members in Congress who want to make it illegal. You know, we have certain states that are trying to make anti-Semitism a crime. What do you think about the fact that AIPAC has so much control over the U.S. Congress?
Well, first part of the question, the fact that they're trying to pass all these laws, both on the state level and on the federal level, that try to make the call for boycott against Israel illegal. But every time they've been taken to court and challenged in court, they were thrown out, because they are not constitutional. The right to boycott is a First Amendment right. Mm-hmm. And Senator Van Hollen from Maryland, who is an avid Israel supporter, 100% Israel and AIPAC supporter, gave an excellent speech on the Senate floor when S1 was being deliberated, discussed, and it included a line that limits the right to boycott against Israel. And he said, this is crossing the line. So to have an avid Israeli supporter say that trying to tell Americans they cannot boycott Israel is crossing the line is a huge accomplishment.
Right.
But it's absurd. You can boycott Russia, you can boycott Iran, you can boycott anybody, but you can't boycott Israel. I mean, that's absurd. And to claim that somehow the call for boycott against Israel is anti-Semitic is also absurd.
Right.
Because what's it got to do with Jews anyway? We're talking about a racist, brutal regime that is imposing apartheid laws against another population, going to the Jews. Any apartheid regime should be boycotted, and the Palestinian demands, in other words, the demands of the call for BDS are absolutely remedial. They talk about justice, they talk about equality, and what is anti-Semitic about that? There's nothing anti-Semitic about it whatsoever. Quite
right.
The opposite.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's completely congruent with the Jewish values. I think it's completely, completely congruent with Jewish values.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, I looked you up on WikiLeaks. Was it WikiLeaks? No, Wikipedia. Pardon me there. And they had a little bit in there. You know, sometimes we don't even know what's out there about us. Some of it true, some of it not. It said that you spoke at a fringe gathering at the British Labour Party conference in September 2017 in Brighton, and that you supposedly said this is about free speech, the freedom to criticize and discuss every issue, whether it's the Holocaust, yes or no. And then it said that you went on to compare Zionists to Nazis and apartheid South Africa racists. Is that true?
Absolutely.
I compare them to them all the time. I say, who are the Nazis now? It's like they're the reincarnation of the Nazi Party, which is now bleeding into the United States.
The way I said it was that first of all, if you believe in free speech, then you cannot rationally disallow people from saying or thinking things. And if people think the Holocaust didn't exist, then you can't penalize for them for that. Okay.
Right.
In fact, I know many Holocaust survivors who have no problem with people rejecting the Holocaust. They welcome the conversation.
Right.
And so, yes, if we believe in free speech, we believe in free speech, and people should be allowed to see. At the same time, I said, we should not give a platform to racists. We should not give a platform to the KKK and to white supremacists and to Nazis and to Zionists. We should not give a platform to any of them because they do not deserve a seat at the table. They are racist.
Right.
And racists do not deserve a seat at the table. It's not like they always say, well, you have to have balance, you have to show both sides.
Right.
I'm going, really? So you're going to have somebody who's a descendant of slaves sitting together with somebody who's a neo-Nazi or a white supremacist, and they get equal time?
Well, you see them marching. You see the neo-Nazis marching freely in America now, you know, interrupting even book signings at bookstores because we have the head Nazi in office that's emboldened these people and given them permission.
Of course, but we don't need to give them a platform. So that's exactly my point.
I agree.
So they took that, and I made headlines in every British paper after that, and Israeli papers, and the Palestinian papers. This thing went on and on and on, and it hasn't stopped yet, actually. People still talk about it. And all I said was that you can't penalize people for thinking things and saying things if you believe in free speech.
Exactly. Well, good for you. You know what they say about publicity. As long as they spell your name right, no one will ever remember with the rest of the article.
So, I guess so.
You know, years ago, Jimmy Carter came out with a book calling Israel an apartheid state. And Jimmy Carter got dragged over the coals for it. But what he wrote was true. Why do they get offended?
Well, actually, he didn't call Israel an apartheid state. I wish he did. He said the apartheid exists only in the West Bank and Gaza, which is not true. Apartheid has existed in the state of Israel from day one. The very first laws that ever passed the Israeli Knesset, the House of Representatives, were absolute apartheid laws. So he did not go far enough, I think. And of course, he got beat up very badly for even saying. But he took out, good for him, you know, he pulled out the word apartheid and he opened that box, which I think it was very courageous. Except that I think he didn't go far enough because the entire country is apartheid, not only the West Bank. But good for him for saying what he said. Again, I wish he would take a full step and reject Zionism and reject Israel altogether.
Well, you know how dangerous that can be for a U.S. president. Okay. I want to go back to, you know, I don't want to talk about it, even though I've talked about it this week, you know, the attack on the U.S. liberty. You know, Lyndon Johnson, you know, Kennedy's assassination, nuclear weapons. You know, to me, Israel's always been the elephant in the living room in the Middle East because they have nuclear weapons and they just don't want their neighbors to have it, but they won't talk about the fact they have nuclear weapons like it's a big secret. Years ago, I interviewed Mordecai Vanunu twice on my show. And to me, he's a hero. But how many people, you know, how many people have even heard about him?
He's paid a price. I see him every time I'm in Jerusalem. You know, he sits in cafes and he waits. He can't go anywhere. He can't do anything. He has been punished for life, you know, for doing what he did. So not only did he serve some 20 years in solitary confinement, now he can't leave, even though there are countries that are quite happy to receive him. So they are very vengeful, and they're probably, you know, trying to say to anybody else who might think of doing the same, you know, you better not try it, because look at Mordechai. But yeah, he's a great hero. He did a world an important service.
Absolutely. He came back on my show even when they forbid him to do any more public speaking.
Yeah, and they do terrible things. They arrest him all the time. They harass him all the time. You know, it's really horrifying to see what they did to him.
But yet they still call themselves the chosen ones of God.
And then look what they're doing to Julian Assange now. I mean, you know, the world does not like, the establishment does not like whistleblowers.
whistleblowers, truth tellers, heroes. You know, yeah. when I was a kid, yeah. we had so many heroes, so many anti-war heroes, and I got to watch them all get shot in a row. So, you know, if people really believe the myths of their countries, they really haven't been doing their homework. let me ask you this. We did talk about the boycott, the divestment sanctions movement, and I'm going to list that website too, bdsmovement.org, in today's archive. What else can the world do? I mean, I've been screaming about this for 20 years. I've been covering, you know, Alison Weir does a great job with her newsletter, If Americans Knew. I put a lot of her information out there. I constantly report on how many Palestinians are being murdered in broad daylight by the Israelis. What else can the average person do?
Well, the first thing they can do is they can look, find out what the BDS, what's on the BDS website, you know, what are the campaigns, what campaigns are going on, how they can participate, find out who are the pro-Palestine groups in their city, on campuses near them. If they're no longer students, they can still support the pro-Palestine groups. There are groups called Students for Justice in Palestine. There are Muslim student associations that sometimes deal with the Palestine issue. There are BDS branches in a lot of cities. Find out who they are, where they are, contact them, support them, be part of that. Make sure that they call and demand that their members of Congress support Betty McCollum's bill about the child prisoners, the Palestinian child prisoners. And, you know, organize, talk to their neighbors, do a book club and then read my book or read this new book. Like I said, Palestine, History of 4,000 Year History, mm-hmm. Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. There are a lot of things that people can do at every different level. I mean, it's good enough if you just don't buy HP or don't buy Israeli-made products, Sabra Hummus, things like that. Mm-hmm. Or you can organize. You can talk to your friends and neighbors and organize a little group and start a campaign in your city, in your neighborhood. There's so many things that people can do. And again, like I said, the call for BDS that came from Palestinian civil society was a gift. It was a gift to people of conscience because they are telling us, here is what we need you to do. And it's something that everybody can do, and I believe everybody should do.
Absolutely.
So get informed and organize and make sure your representative knows where you stand. Mm-hmm. Particularly on this issue of child prisoners and the detention and torture of children, and read the bill, read Betty McCollum's bill, because it lists all the things exactly the way Israel treats these children that are being detained and tortured. It's a very well written bill. It's very true, mm-hmm. and you know, she's, I don't know if she's going to get 30 co-sponsors, but she needs to. But how can we argue about this issue when it's children, you know?
Right. Well, what was that 17-year-old girl that they locked up for smacking one of the Gestapo?
Yeah,
I forget her name. Free.
I had to Mimi.
Right. And now, you know, her brother's been arrested. You know, then they arrest the mother. Then they go after this one. I mean, how can people turn a blind eye to that? To me, that young woman was like Joan of Arc.
Yeah, exactly. She's a Joan of Arc. She's a hero. She's also the daughter of one of my best friends, so I've known her for many, many years, and her father, you know, I've known her, the full family, for many, many years. And she did absolutely what many, many people want to do. And the thing is, they came against her. They came out against her, you know, as a woman daring to challenge patriarchy, as a young girl daring to challenge an officer, as a Palestinian daring to challenge an Israeli. I mean, she did all of that with that one slap. And that's why they came against her. And there's a very well-known Israeli, several Israeli journalists, all of the Israeli journalists actually came out against her, saying things like, well, you know, she needs to be taken out and to a dark place and dealt with and without cameras and things like that. I mean, horrifying things were said about her in the Israeli media and on the streets. But the truth is, that smack was a smack against patriarchy. Right. It was a smack against white supremacy. It was a smack against settler colonialism. And you know, she's a wonderfully proud young woman.
Well, she's a hero. Next time you see her, please give her a kiss from me. She's welcome on my show anytime. But you know what? I've gotten banned on Facebook over a dozen times, and it's always when I post something, some of the truth about Israel. But I was one of her biggest fans. I mean, there wasn't anything about her I didn't cover and encourage. And she needs to know that she speaks for all women all around the world.
Yeah, and she says that. She says she speaks for all Palestinian prisoners. She said, you know, I was treated nicely. And her mother said this too, because I look blonde and I look like them,
right,
then they treated me a little bit nicer. But I speak for all Palestinian prisoners.
Well, that girl's got, I'll tell you what, she's got the courage of 100 lions, and I'm so proud of her.
She does.
Well, yeah. Miko, I really enjoyed talking to you again. I hope we get to do this again.
Absolutely.
And keep doing what you're doing, because I intend to keep doing what I'm doing too.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. You take good care now.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, see that? They're heroes on the planet, and they even from the strangest places. So maybe we do have Buddha, and we have Joan of Arc. Maybe we have all kinds of great people walking this planet, doing the right thing. Miko Peled, you're going to want to check out his work, check out his book. Like he said, we have to go beyond solidarity now. We have to go to resistance, and we need to do that here too. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'll be back tomorrow with the news. And again, thanks for supporting the show. This is real independent media.
Thank you for listening and supporting the Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.